Morning Edition and Morning News with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you in part by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and the Promontory Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and our pleasure to come every Monday morning and tell you about what's going on in the world of money and local business. And we have local businessman Brian Knepper, different kind of business. He is one of the owners with his doctor wife of a new urgent care facility in out in Kimball Junction, and we'll be talking with Brian Knepper to start off the show. Then we'll be talking with Casey Ring, who is president and founder of Upward Personal Finance. And Doug, you're in the personal finance advising world too, and he has a different, interesting model that should appeal to a lot of people.
He does have a different model. You know, the challenge is how do you get the quality advice to the everyday public, and that's a challenge. We're fortunate to work with a group of families that have built up their net worth. But as families are starting off on that, it's important to have quality advice, and it sounds like that's his business model. We'll find out more. And then our final guest is going to be James Rickards. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He wrote the book The Death of Money and also Currency Wars. He's also an advisor to the Department of Defense on things like financial war games. And his latest book is The New Case for Gold, where he makes an argument that we all should own some gold, and also makes an argument about going back to the gold standard. So we'll find out more about that. And Larry, I know you always open on Monday with the weather. Boy, my luck on Mondays here. I missed last week when it was sunny. But like for the last 5 weeks, we've had rain or snow on Mondays.
And it's,
I've been here.
Bring it on. Bring it on. We live in a high-altitude desert, so it's great. And we'll have showers off and on throughout the day, looking for a high of just 48 and a low of 30. So the moisture this evening could well be snow. And if you look halfway up Treasure Mountain, it does turn to snow about halfway up, maybe about the 7,500-foot level.
It's so messing up my mountain biking aspirations for next weekend, but that's okay. We, as you point out, we need the water. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Additional funding for programming is provided in part by Park City Brewery Tap Room, 2720 Rasmussen Road, parkcitybrewery.com, Facebook. CNS Creative, Strategic Marketing, Advertising, and Web Design, cscreate.com. Hideout Canyon, Master Planned Community on the Lake, info at hideoutcanyon.com. Summit Injury Law, Park City's personal injury law firm, summitinjurylawyers.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We have Brian Knepper in the studio with us now. He is CEO of StatMD, and this is a new full-service urgent care facility that's at Kimball Junction. It's on Uinta Way there. Opened last October with two doctors to see you, one being your bride.
Yes, indeed. She's out here ready, willing, and able.
Very good. Well, tell us what full-service urgent care facility. So what breadth of services and patients do you see?
We can see patients that are aged pediatrics all the way up to geriatrics. We can treat minor illnesses, sprains and strains, all the way up to fractures and sutures. We have x-ray on site. We have procedure rooms where we are able to splint, cast, and take care of whatever needs you may have.
So urgent care as opposed to emergency care, where's the line?
Urgent care really is primarily designed for people who need to be seen urgently, which is I need to be seen today, can't get in to see perhaps your primary care doctor or don't have the time. It would not be appropriate for emergencies, people who are having heart attacks, stroke, that need intensive care in an emergency department.
But say around Park City, someone breaks their leg skiing. Instead of going to the ER, they could come to you?
Yeah, the benefit of coming to us for common things that we're seeing, such as skiing injuries, certainly mountain biking injuries, is that we have reduced wait times. We have reduced fee structures. And if there is anything complicated, we have the ability to set you up with subspecialists that are in the area. So in the example of someone who's had a leg fracture, we'll be able to see that on X-ray. We'll put it into a cast after consulting with a local orthopedic surgeon and make sure that that orthopedic surgeon has got you scheduled for follow-up and that we've taken the appropriate actions to get you ready.
So talk to us about why there's a need for urgent care facilities in the U.S.'s healthcare system.
It's our opinion that my wife and I that the healthcare system is sick. I think many people would agree with that. There's a shortage of primary care physicians nationwide, certainly in this area as well. Physicians are overworked, don't have the time to spend with patients that sometimes is required. And if they've double or triple booked during that day, they just can't squeeze you in. We're able to do that. Our goal is to get people in and out of our clinic in under an hour, and we keep that metric pretty tight.
So I'm curious. You know, one of the things that people say about the U.S. medical system is, oh, we don't want to do what Canada does. We don't want to do what they're doing in Europe. We have the best system. You can get the services that you need. And it's fee-for-service, obviously, here. But if you look at Canada, are there any urgent care facilities in shopping centers like your centers at Kimball?
Yeah.
Does that model exist in places like Canada that have more socialized medicine?
You know, I'm not an expert on OUS urgent care centers, but to my knowledge, it hasn't taken hold there as it has here. People with urgent situations in those countries do go to the emergency room, which, as many people know, when you walk through the door, it's a minimum of a $250 charge just for a facility fee at the emergency room. For us, we do take insurance, but we also have a fee structure on a cash basis for
so
those.
Somebody
who
has strep throat,
yeah.
Or they, you know, their throat hurts. They think they might, and they come in and they're going to pay cash. What does it cost to get tested for strep throat?
We have a $125 fee to be seen by a physician, and that will include all in-house labs, which could be strep throat. It could be rule out of flu. It could be a variety of things, a urinalysis, things that we can test for right there that we do not send out to the hospital.
Now, you came to Park City from a career in Wall Street, but it's a career that was based in medicine. You're on the Board of Governors at Johns Hopkins Hospital Heart and Vascular Institute and former chair of the External Advisory Committee of the Charles Bronfman Institute for Personalized Medicine at Mount Sinai, also in New York. So you have knowledge, in addition to being married to a doctor,
right,
as well, of the healthcare system. Is urgent care facility like yours filling a gap that isn't there otherwise?
Absolutely. You know, I think that we have seen utilization in the United States of the emergency rooms gone up as our healthcare policy has changed.
It's kind of become the neighborhood doctor's clinic for people with anything wrong who don't have regular healthcare.
And that is very expensive to the system and to the individuals. We can fill that gap because, as we were speaking about before, by design, my clinic is not filled with emergency medicine trained physicians and nurse practitioners. They are all trained in primary care, family medicine, because those are a lot of the things that we're seeing. Anything that requires emergent care should go to the hospital. But for urinary tract infections, upper respiratory infections, so those are strokes, pneumonia, sore throats. These are things that we can address very easily, as well as all the sprains, strains, fractures, and cuts that we discussed before.
Now, you included in that list strokes. Did you mean to include strokes? That's something you can go to urgent care for?
If you are having symptoms that concern you, we can diagnose, say, stroke and heart attack. We will stabilize and provide supportive care while we're waiting for the EMTs to come and take you to the hospital. And we have seen both of those cases come into our clinic.
Yeah, I just asked because you mentioned stroke in that list, and we talked about that in the green room. Another thing we talked about was your facility practices what you called evidence-based medicine. What is that, and how is that different?
Evidence-based medicine, as I was describing before, really relies on what has been published and what has been proven to be true. I did express that that comes with a cost because we have Dr. Google now. People do come in and sometimes self-diagnose and self-treat and say, this is what I have. Our practice is to go in and say, first, do no harm. That's the primary tenet of medicine. And so the customer service that we believe we need to provide is make sure people are safe. If they believe that they are sick, but we don't believe that their medical history or their symptoms necessarily indicate what they're asking for, we will educate them. We make every patient a part of our decision process. And we then go ahead and follow up with everyone within 24 hours of being seen in our clinic to make sure that not only that they're not worsening, but that they're getting better. If in the event we're wrong and we didn't prescribe medication that perhaps could have benefited a patient, rather than make that patient come back in and waste their time and waste their money by charging them again, we're happy to modify the treatment appropriately. So we've had great success with that, and we've had a very high patient satisfaction.
Do you have I've noticed in the last few years it's common practice that, you know, everybody gets sick with the same sicknesses, and the human body is the human body. So do your doctors go to the computer, or I've seen them pull out their cell phone and go down checklists. If you have this, then we do this. If you have that, then we do this. Do you have a strict protocol like that, and is that making medicine more efficient?
It is, and we do for certain illnesses. My wife, Jen, does set up protocols, but all of the providers have the ability to deviate from those protocols based on, you know, if a patient has an allergy to a medication or if they've had something that works better in the past. We also are tied into the Department of Health. We see certain resistance in Utah that is not seen nationwide, certain diseases. That certainly is something that Jen takes into account when determining treatment algorithms. And we also provide all of our practitioners a tool called UpToDate, which provides the most current research to support evidence-based medicine. So that they can be assisted in making their decisions.
You know, I'm curious, just taking Larry's question one step further. You've got a really strong business background. And Larry's talking about these online algorithms to help the physician that's seeing you make the best decisions possible. I've seen that taken actually to the next level. And I think in Utah it's not legal yet, but in some states it is, where people go onto their iPad. Mm-hmm. And they visit with a physician over their iPad and talk about the symptoms. And in many states, they can actually prescribe drugs via that route. Did you look at that? You're a business person.
We did.
Did you look at, you know, maybe this is a business model that you and your wife would consider? What do you see as the pros and cons of that business?
So telemedicine is something that we've considered, and it is legal in Utah. We introduced it, so we went a little further than exploring. We actually paid for the platform and to have it integrated. We didn't find great traction in the area. I think that people still want to see their physician, despite the fact that you can see the provider on many of these platforms through a Skype-like interaction. You still want to be treated and touched and felt. You have to remember that medicine is not boilerplate. It cannot be brought down to algorithms, no matter how many factors you plug into them, because every patient is different. If algorithms were perfect, we would have no need for medicine. We would have no or for doctors or for medical school and for training. And I think that's the struggle that some of our providers nationally deal with is, hey, I've been to medical school. I've seen a lot of these things. I've been trained. And people are coming in and saying, well, this is the algorithm that I'm reading on Google.
If medicine were perfect, let's talk about
okay,
that. Because
go ahead.
Unfortunately, we're far from perfect.
We are.
Here in the U.S., and I suspect no country has it down perfectly. But let's talk about, you know, you mentioned earlier there's a shortage of primary care physicians. There's certainly no shortage of young people that would love to be doctors, that are very bright, that could likely be excellent doctors. There's actually a shortage of seats at medical schools. If there's such a shortage of primary care physicians, why don't we open up more seats at the nation's medical schools?
I think that's a great question and probably a platform for another time, but I think the issue is the cost of medical school and training is extraordinarily high. And young people will go to medical school and come out with several hundred thousand dollars in debt. They then go through a residency where they're making, maybe $30,000. And then they get out, and in primary care, the reimbursement happens to be, very low. And therefore, they say, I have to be able to pay my bills and my overhead. And with the litigious society that we live in, there's also malpractice, which is quite expensive. And I can tell you that Jen had the despite being extraordinarily well trained, had to make the decision at a point in her life of, do I want to be a mother or do I want to work part-time? Part-time to her was 4 days a week, and no medical system felt that that investment would allow them to make any money because they, in their words, still had to pay full overhead for her, which means malpractice for as if she were working 5 days a week, despite having been in practice for over 20 years with not a single lawsuit or anything like that. So that's an unfortunate issue that people have to deal with, and that I think contributes to the shortage of primary care physicians.
Okay, just time for one last question. Is an urgent care facility like yours, for those who don't have a regular doctor, an adequate substitute? I mean, here in Summit County, we're the healthiest county in Utah. We all like to think we're mountain men and women that right. can hop on a bike and ride to the top of Jupiter or wherever. And do we really need a primary care doctor in our youth? And is just knowing urgent care is available good enough for medicine?
It can be, providing you don't have any, long-term comorbidities. If you don't have diabetes that needs to be managed or high blood pressure, but if it's, I'm a healthy person. I was mountain biking. I hurt myself. I want to get treated so I can get back out there and have fun. We're a great solution for that.
Okay. So are you, tell us where you are again as we leave, and, are you there 24 hours a day or what?
We're there Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., Saturday and Sunday, 9 to 5, and we are in Kimball Junction, directly across from the Smith's gas station is the best landmark.
Okay, 1784 Uinta Way.
Yes, sir.
Stat MD. Okay, Brian Knepper, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And when we come
Craig
back,
McCarthy with the
talk
City
about
Chamber Bureau.
Personal
Being
finance
a member of the
with
Chamber
Casey
Bureau
Ring, the president and founder of Upward Personal Finance. After this.
Commercial lender for Mountain West Bank. We are proud to support Mountain Money on KPCW, but not responsible for the opinions of Larry or Doug. Our community is unique, and so are Park City businesses. We offer loan solutions to help your business succeed. Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theaters. 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hello, I'm Rick Redford.
And I'm Gordo Cummins with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
We provide transportation to the airport, Park City, Deer Valley, and all other Utah resorts, utilizing private black cars, SUVs, and vans.
Reservations at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
And now we have Casey Ring in the studio, also with a new business in the community. Heber City, are you?
That's where I'm located, yes.
Okay. And Casey is president and founder of Upward Personal Finance, financial planning and coaching to help younger families.
That's right.
Your focus is different. Most people go where the big money is.
That's right. We've got a lot of financial advisors and planners really focusing on that pre-retiree.
On wealth management.
And wealth management, exactly. And I did that for several years myself in private banking. And it was a very quick realization that the people that I was helping really had many people clamoring for their business. And the folks that really do need the help, there was no place really where they could go for that. And that's where my business model was born from.
So Casey, Larry mentioned at the open that I'm in the business of
right.
money management and wealth management as well. And you're absolutely right. You know, for folks that have built up their net worth, they have a lot of choices of who to work with. Unfortunately, most of the industry is really salespeople.
That's right.
And folks need to know that. Your model's different.
It is.
Your model is fee only. And
that's right.
You're also working with people that are building up their net worth.
Yes.
And Larry addressed the younger generation. Let's talk about fee only. What is that and why is that important?
Fee only was a confusing terminology when I first started the business. I think there's
that's because you joined a firm that worked on the commission and the sales side.
Exactly.
It's actually not so confusing, is it? So just
right.
Explain.
I think it's more confusing for the consumer. So basically, a fee only individual such as yourself, myself, I'm not in the business to sell a particular product or be it insurance or an investment product or a managed fee portfolio. I am strictly charging my clients for my time based on their particular specific need. So that frees me up to be able to kind of shop for my clients based on what their specific need is. I'm not really tied, well, I'm not tied at all to any brokerage house or firm that may be saying to me, these are your sales quotas that you need to meet.
So by fee only, does that mean you are just charging a flat fee per hour or per project for somebody? Or
that's exactly right.
You're taking a small percentage of what their portfolio is?
I do not manage assets. So I am not charging a specific percentage based on the assets that they have under management.
So your niche is just providing unfiltered advice.
That's correct. So a way that I've structured it for my clientele, I like these kind of project-based pricing models. I have a newlywed financial boot camp, which I think is hugely important when you enter a partnership or a marriage. You may have differing opinions on how the family finances should be managed. So I've put together a specific product that covers four or five different, I guess, modules within a financial plan, but it's specific to newlyweds. And then I have a project-based model where I simply meet with my client. They tell me what their pain points are or goals and objectives that they have, and I'll price it out for them.
So Casey, you know, people have access to tools to help them online many of these things. The challenge is, I think most of us, when it comes to our money, right? We work really hard for our money. We work hard to save it. We want to invest it in the best way. And for a lot of folks, that means they want to be able to sit down with somebody, and that's what you do. You know, some of the services online are incredibly inexpensive.
Yes.
But sometimes you get what you pay for.
Exactly.
Your model, I've looked on your ADV, which is filed with the SEC, and consumers out there should know that anybody can look up any advisor's ADV. It's really important that
What's
do that.
What's an ADB?
ADV, it's a disclosure form, basically, that you all advisors file with the SEC if they're regulated by the SEC. And it's easy to get online. Just go to sec.gov, and you should absolutely do that before you work with anybody in this business. I've done that on Casey's file. She has what's called a clean ADV, meaning there's no complaints. You also list some of your pricing for your services.
Yes.
So it's more than what people are going to pay online, but I would argue it's very affordable. Share with us like the newlywed package and some of the package, and share pricing with us.
Sure. And that was done on purpose as well, because in my research prior to launching my business, you can go to any advisor's page platform and fees are hidden. They're not up front. And so I really wanted to be forthright with my clientele and say, this is what I charge on an hourly basis for projects. It's $150. If you do my full financial plan, which is a one-year commitment, it's $2,400 or $200 a month. So we can break it out for clients. And again, the $150 an hour based if you just want a specific project for me to help you with. So yes, that is quite a bit more than what you can get by doing a robo or just looking online.
But it's tailored for you,
and
that's important. You know, the problem with the robos is they have good tools, but they make generalizations, right? Just be if you're 25 years old and getting married and just starting off, your situation's probably different in important ways than kind of the average. So I think having some customized for you has a lot of value. I'll share a story. When I was 20 years old, I graduated from undergrad. My undergrad's in engineering, started working, and I looked for a financial advisor. I was a weird 20-year-old. Most 20-year-olds don't look for a financial advisor. But I'm looking at 40 years of working in front of me, and I wanted to know, how much do I need to save, and can I retire 30 years from now or 25? I wanted a game plan.
That's right.
I had a really hard time
finding something.
Well, actually, Bob Jenkins in Memphis, Tennessee, who's probably passed away now, I still have that plan. I'm now 52 years old, so 30-plus years later. But it's really, really hard. I would say, though, huge difference having that game plan. Every year I would look at it and say, how am I doing versus the plan? What I didn't plan on was, you know, now I'm at 52 and some of the numbers there I've hit, but I really enjoy working. But it's nice to know you have a plan and you're building towards something.
That's right. And being able to have a professional who's willing to look at all those different angles for you without having the big portfolio to bring to the table, that's been the challenge for the younger demographic or those of us who maybe got a little bit of a late start. So I really wanted to focus on being able to, in an affordable way, work with the folks who don't have a big portfolio yet.
So can you answer questions like, say, a young married couple trying to build their wealth, they're thinking, well, maybe we should buy a rental property and fix it up, or maybe we should put it into a certain stock or a certain mutual fund. Can you analyze that kind of a financial planning issue for them?
Absolutely. And I think first and foremost, it's the tailored specific. It's listening to the client and understanding what are their values around money. How do they feel about their money? Where do they want to take their financial future? And so we would talk about, you know, having a rental property versus the risk of being in the markets. And there's risks to both sides. What can you handle? What are you comfortable with? So I think really taking the time on the front end to understand a client and how they feel about money and their goals and objectives will help you to kind of craft what would be more than just the numbers of it, right?
So, Casey, we only have time for one last question.
Sure.
And I want to ask you something open-ended. What do you wish that young people knew that when you visit with them initially that you find most people don't understand?
There's several things, but one of the big things that I find interesting about the younger generation, they've been told that credit cards and loans are evil, owing money to the bank and having a credit card and these things are horrible and they're going to get you in a lot of trouble. And for good reason, we've talked about that a lot. But done in the right way, it can bolster your net worth very rapidly. So I do meet with a lot of younger people who are either confused about starting credit or they don't really know how it can benefit them because they've been told so much that it's watch out, be careful. It can get you in a lot of trouble. A lot of times I spend a lot of time talking about how that actually benefits you in the long run and you can make money off your credit card.
I am so glad to hear you say that young people are cautious with that because
yes.
They should be.
Yes.
It is a tool. You need to know how to use it. You need to understand the downsides of it, but so I'm glad to hear you say that. That's a great note for us to wrap up. Our guest this morning has been Casey Ring. She's the president and founder of Upward Personal Finance in Heber City. Casey, if people are interested, how do they get in touch with you?
Visit my website, upwardpersonalfinance.com. It has all my contact information. The cool thing about what I do is I don't really keep normal business hours. So for my clients that are busy during the day, I have evening and weekends too. We do a lot of Skype and Google Hangouts. So,
okay. Well, Casey, the world needs more fee-only financial planners. I'm glad you have decided to go that route. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And when we come back, we're going to be talking about gold with James Rickards, author of The New Case for Gold. Heading to a high of 48 degrees under cloudy skies. Going to be on and off rain showers and maybe some snow tonight as we head down to 30 degrees. We'll be back to talk about gold after this.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Mound Money. We're going to keep on the topic of financial business aspects. We've got hopefully on the phone with us James Rickards. I heard the ringtone going there. So we will talk a little bit about his book before we get there. He's written the book called The New Case for Gold. He's also a New York Times best-selling author, having previously written a book called The Death of Money and also Currency Wars. I think we're waiting for him to get on the line. So while we're waiting, Larry, I'll just share. You know, it's interesting. Both of the entrepreneurs that we just talked to, you know, one deals with the inefficiencies in the healthcare system. The other, I would argue, is dealing with some of the inefficiencies in the financial advising space. The need to have somebody that's fee only, that's a fiduciary for you. I understand we now have James Rickards, the author of The New Case for Gold. James, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So your book makes the case that maybe the gold standard, it's time to reconsider that. Maybe that's not something that we did at the turn of the century before we, quote, got more sophisticated. Why do you think the gold standard might make sense?
Well, I talk about that in my book, The New Case for Gold, as one of a number of possibilities. It could be a strict gold standard. It could be just using gold as a reference. But the point is today, in the international monetary system, there is no anchor at all, and that explains why we're in these currency wars, why we see big swings in the value of the dollar. It's part of the reason world growth isn't as strong as it should be. You know, from the 1870s to 1914, we had a strict gold standard. From 1914 to 1971, we had various kinds of modified gold standards. Some work better than others. But since 1980 to 2010, we've been on a dollar standard, really no standard at all. And today, even that's gone because we've at various times tried to cheapen the dollar to help exports. So we have no standard at all. I've spoken to Ben Bernanke and others. They find the international monetary system literally incoherent, probably heading for a collapse. So my thought is let's stabilize the system before it collapses.
But what we have now is the faith and credit of the United States of America. Full faith and credit of the United States of America. Isn't that good enough to support the dollar and the world economy?
Well, it is until it isn't. And what I mean by that is, you know, I get into a lot of debates about, you know, the dollar. People want to talk about Bitcoin or the euro. And people say, well, these currencies are not backed by anything. Well, they are backed by one thing, which is confidence. If you think it's money and I think it's money and you're willing to accept it to me and you're confident that someone else will accept it for you, then it can be money. I mean, at various times, feathers have been money, clamshells have been money. Really, anything can be money if people have confidence in it. The problem is confidence is very fragile. It's very easily lost. And once it's lost, first of all, people can lose confidence very quickly, and it's very hard to regain. So my concern is that policymakers at the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen and her colleagues, are taking confidence for granted. They think they can print as much money, go to negative interest rates, keep rates too low too long, fight the currency wars, bail out the banks, do all these things, and somehow confidence in the dollar will never be lost. Well, that's been true so far, but we may be getting at the outer limits of that. And, of course, the problem is once people lose confidence, as they say, it goes away quickly and cannot be regained. And gold would be at least a break on that or something that would add to some confidence.
Yeah, so it's a huge concern with a dollar-backed currency, the full faith and credit of any government. Once confidence is lost, as you point out, things can fall apart very, very quickly. Talk to us about why we moved away from the gold standard in the first place.
It was even illegal to own gold for most FDR. Of the last century.
Well, not for short periods of time.
Yeah, that's a great story, and I talk about it in my book, The New Case for Gold. Two things happened. Number one, there was the disappearance of physical gold, and then secondly, there was the disappearance of gold as an idea or a concept, really the gold standard. You know, as late as the 1910s, you know, the early part of the 20th century, people still had gold coins in their pockets. Not all of them, not all the time, but there was a $20 gold coin. It was basically an ounce of gold. Gold was $20 an ounce at the time. Well, first during World War One, they scooped up all the gold coins and they melted it down into bars, these 400-ounce bars. So you could still own gold, but obviously nobody's going to walk around with a 400-ounce bar. That's a 35-pound bar in their pockets. So that sort of took gold out of circulation, put it in the banks. Then the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, and it wasn't long before the Federal Reserve said to the banks, because it's privately owned by the banks, that you have to give us your gold, in effect, to buy your stock in the Federal Reserve. So then step two, you know, the gold went from individual banks to the Federal Reserve. Then in 1934, the U.S. Treasury confiscated the gold from the Federal Reserve, and that's why they built Fort Knox to house all that gold. So first the banks took it from the people, then the Federal Reserve took it from the banks, then the Treasury took it from the Federal Reserve, and little by little it all ended up, most of it anyway, in hands. And it was in the hands of the government, and it was illegal for citizens to own gold from 1933 to 1975. So, you know, 42 years, gold was like, you know, drugs or any kind of contraband, or you could go to jail if you had it. So today, individuals can own gold. The government, of course, we don't have a gold standard. That's long gone. But I advise people, you can go on a personal gold standard. We all get paid in dollars for whatever we do, but take some of your dollars, I recommend about 10%, convert it to gold, put it in a safe place, and now you're on a personal gold standard. No matter what happens to the dollar, your wealth will be preserved.
So, James, I wanted to get there, but since you mentioned it, I was going to do it later in the show. I want to make the case for gold and then talk about how to own it. But since you just mentioned that, you know, the challenge with having gold is it's something that's very valuable. I would argue you do not want that under your bed. You do not want that buried in your backyard. If people do want to have some gold, what's a safe way for them to own physical gold?
Well, there are a couple safe ways. One is keep it in non-bank storage. There are a lot of secure logistics providers, vault operators. Don't put it in the bank because the banks are heavily regulated, and if the government decided they wanted to lock down the gold somehow, of course the banks are the first place they'd look. So I would not keep it in a bank safe deposit box. But there are plenty of private vault operators. I don't want to recommend a particular name, but certainly there are names like Brinks and Dunbar and Loomis and others who have been around for, you know, Brinks case, well over 100 years. But there are a lot of local operators who are fine also. You have to do your homework. Make sure they're reputable. Make sure they've been in business a long time. Get some references. Make sure they have insurance in case anything goes wrong. You're the beneficiary of an insurance policy. And, you know, a legitimate vault operator will let you come in and you know, look around. I've been inside a number of vaults. So that's one option. The other option, there are gold IRAs. Again, I don't want to recommend a particular dealer or administrator, but they're out there. And, of course, if you're in an IRA that is regulated by the government to some extent, by the Department of Labor and the Department of Treasury, and they offer storage. So there are a number of programs. There's some gold funds. Now, I do not recommend what I would call paper gold, such as ETFs or exchange-traded funds. But there are some gold funds. Sprott is one. Physical gold fund is another, where you buy a unit. Okay, so you're buying a unit. You're not buying the gold. But they take the money and buy the gold and store it safely, not in a bank. And if you ever want your gold, you can call up and they'll deliver it the next day. So there's no, really no problems getting the physical gold. But in the meantime, your gold is represented by unit, and the gold itself is held by the fund and kept in a safe place. So there are a number of ways to do it. If you do have it at home and a home safe, the best security, by the way, is not a safe. The best security is don't tell anyone you have it.
Exactly. Now, maybe because we're out here in the Rockies in the west, along I-80 in Nevada is a geological formation called the Carlin Trend, and all along I-80, a few miles off the road either side, are huge gold mines, and they are bringing more gold out of the ground every year. So what about another investment alternative, which would be to buy the companies, the stocks in the companies that that own the gold. And I guess there's even gold futures. You can buy gold in the ground like hog bellies and soybean futures. What about some of those alternatives?
Well, I wouldn't touch the gold futures, and let me explain why. Because and you're right, they're traded on the COMEX in New York, the commodity exchange, and they're like, pork bellies or lumber futures, all kinds of futures contracts, so you're right. But the problem is those are paper contracts. Now, right now, and this is true of all futures, what's called the open interest, that's the total amount of contracts outstanding, can be 100 times or more the amount of physical gold. So the COMEX does have some physical gold in a warehouse, a designated warehouse in New York. But the number of people who have bought gold futures is 100 times, not the number of people, but the quantity of gold represented by the futures contracts is 100 times the physical gold. If all those people showed up and asked for delivery of the gold, only the first guy would get it. The other 99 would be out of luck. In other words, and in fact, that's not what would happen. What would happen, if too many longs demanded delivery of the gold, the exchange would change the rules, which they have the power to do, and say that nobody can take delivery. You can only close out your contract. So what will happen is you'll get your profits through yesterday, and they'll terminate your contract, send you a dollar check for yesterday's price, but you won't have any physical gold going forward. So the time you want your gold the most is when you won't be able to get it, because when is everybody going to demand physical delivery? Well, that's going to happen when, the price of gold is shooting up $100 an ounce, $200 an ounce per day. You know, it's skyrocketing, and everybody says, uh-oh, now the collapse is coming, I better get my gold. Well, that's exactly the same time when they're going to suspend trading and send you a check for yesterday's price. So you're not going to get your gold when you want it. As far as the that's the main problem with what I call paper gold contracts. As I say, there are as far as gold miners are concerned, the problem with gold miners, you're right, a gold miner, the way the accounting works, is actually a leverage bet on gold. And what I mean by that is if gold goes up 10%, a mining stock could easily go up 20 or 30%. But, of course, the opposite is true. If gold goes down 10%, the mining stock could drop 20 or 30%. So take whatever gold is doing and then kind of multiply it, and that's how gold stocks perform. The problem with gold stocks is there are some great companies out there. So there's some ones that, Barrick Gold and IM Gold and Anglo Gold. But there are also there's some frauds and there's some bankrupts. Are companies heading for bankruptcy? So how do you know as an investor kind of which ones are the solid companies and which ones are not? Well, you can find out, but that's a lot of research. So there you might consider gold funds that own portfolios of stocks. There's the Tocqueville Gold Fund is one, and there's some others out there that are good ones. But if you're going to buy individual miners, you really need to do your homework. One way to play that is with what are called streamers. These are royalty companies. There's Franco Nevada, Royal Gold, and Silver Wheaton are the three best known.
No, James, I'm going to interrupt and say you're making the case to own physical gold, and so all of those things come with complications. Even if you do your research and find a great company, you're suggesting that people hold this gold for 10, 20, 30 years as really insurance. And a lot can change in 10, 20, 30 years. And even if folks find a great gold company today, they may be a lousy gold miner in 10 years. So let's stick on the concept of physical gold. It's a good question. The alternatives, we've chatted about that. So let's talk about physical gold. Why does physical gold have value? You open saying that, the dollar is basically based on the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. Why does gold have value?
Well, it's a subjective determination, but that's true of all forms of money. One of the criticisms of gold, and you hear this from Warren Buffett most famously, they say gold has no yield. If you own stocks or bonds or whatever, it has some yield, 5% or 2%. They're pretty low if you have money in the bank these days, which isn't really money. It's a bank deposit. And they say gold has no yield. Well, gold is not supposed to have a yield because it's money. If you reach in your wallet or your purse and pull out a dollar bill and hold it in front of you, what's the yield? Well, the yield is zero. If you want yield, you have to go do something with it. You could put it in the bank. But once you put it in the bank, it's not money anymore. I mean, people call it money, but what it really is an unsecured liability of an occasionally insolvent banking system. So So if you want yield, you have to take some risk, and that's fine. But money in the purest form does not have any yield. So whether it's a dollar bill, euro, yen, gold, Bitcoin for that matter, they're all forms of money. So which one is the best? Well, it's a subjective preference. At certain times, you know, if I saw better policy coming from the United States, if we didn't have the deficits we do, if we didn't have the debt we do, if we didn't have the money printing we do, if we had structural reforms, if we had changes in labor laws, tax laws, things that would make the U.S. economy stronger, I wouldn't have any particular case for gold. I would say, well, you know, the dollar is as good as gold. But none of that's true. We have, you know, I think listeners are probably familiar with a $19 trillion national debt and $400 billion deficits, probably getting worse, a rising debt-to-GDP ratio that puts you on the path to Greece, $4 trillion of money printing. In fact, all of the policies are heading the wrong way. And so at what point do people subjectively say, you know, my preference is now shifting away from that dollar towards gold? That's something that is happening slowly now, but it can accelerate. So the value of gold comes from just asking people, what do you think the best form of money is? It's a subjective preference, but my view is the way trends are heading, that preference is going to swing very, very heavily in favor of gold. You know, I'm not one of these, I don't think I'm your traditional gold bug. I haven't spent the last 25 years sitting in my basement counting gold coins. My background is really in the bond market, derivatives, hedge funds, banking. But I arrived at the gold scene through a careful study of federal finance. As I looked around, it was clear that the U.S. is heading for a dollar crisis. And so when you say, well, gee, what are the alternatives? You know, if the dollar goes down, the euro is not going to do much better. So I kind of arrived at gold through a process of elimination.
Yeah, and
the one thing that will hold value.
And, you know, you did say you're not one of the gold bugs who hides in the basement, but there are a lot of them out there, and they're the ones who make a lot of the cases for owning gold. And I note that your previous two books were Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis, and your most recent previous book was The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System. And those do sound like doom and gloom forecasts that would dictate your run to gold.
Well, hopefully they're good analysis. I hope readers enjoy them. But, you know, currency wars are a reality that you can't pick up a newspaper, whether it's the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, the New York Times, and go around the world. They all discuss currency wars, and they have for the last 5 years. That's the only policy tool central bankers have left. You know, when you're at zero, how do you ease when you're at zero interest rates? Well, you can go to negative interest rates, although there's a lot of evidence that that doesn't work. But the best way to do it, or the easiest way to do it, is to cheapen your currency. And that's what's going on now. You know, the dollar recently was at a 10-year high, coming off the August 2011 all-time low. So from 2011 to 2016, the dollar got stronger. Well, it looks like now the dollar is weakening because the U.S. economy is slowing down. We're taking the canteen, if you will, back from Europe and Japan, saying, you guys are going to have a stronger yen and a stronger euro. We're going to have a weaker dollar, and for that matter, a weaker Chinese yuan, because China and the U.S. need some relief. So the currency war is a reality, and that's what my first book is about. As far as the death of money is concerned, yeah, when I talk about the collapse of the international monetary system, the international monetary system actually has collapsed three times in the past 100 years, 1914, 1939, and 1971. It seems to have a shelf life of about 30 or 40 years. It's been over 40 years since the last collapse. That doesn't mean it'll happen tomorrow like clockwork. It does mean nobody should be surprised if it does. But here's the point. When the system collapses, it doesn't mean that everyone, you know, lives in caves and eats canned goods. It's not the end of the world. What it does mean is that the major trading financial powers sit down around the table and they rewrite what they call the rules of the game. Think of it as the operating system for the international monetary system. They come up with new rules. Well, the next time that happens, and it's probably going to be sooner than later, your gold, it's kind of like a poker game. What do you want in a poker game? You want a big pile of chips. So gold is going to be your pile of chips. This is why China has bought 4,000 tons. Russia has bought 1,000 tons. Iran's buying gold. Turkey's buying gold. The U.S. is not selling any. Actually, the Western Central Bank stopped selling gold 6 years ago. They had been selling for about 25 years, but they stopped on a dime. And now central banks are net buyers of gold. So they see this coming. and they're getting ready. As I say, it's not the end of the world, but it is going to lead to a new system where gold is going to have a much higher value, and you may actually not be able to get gold when the time comes. So
James,
I recommend getting it now.
Yeah. So in many ways, you're describing gold as insurance. I think it's fair to classify it that way. At the start of our interview, you mentioned having 10% gold. That's, you know, if a client came to me, I'm in the money management business. If a client came to me and said, for all the reasons you've articulated here, I want to own gold, you know, I'd say there's nothing wrong with, just like I have a life insurance policy on myself. Right. I hope it never pays off. Unfortunately, right. At some point it will. So using gold as insurance makes sense. You suggested 10%. My feedback is that sounds a little high, but let's say it's in the 5 to 10% range as insurance. How does somebody know when they should sell that gold?
Well, there's a good chance you should never sell it. Keep it to preserve wealth and give it to your children. By the way, just to be clear, I recommend 10% of your investable assets, but I exclude home equity and business equity. So take your home equity, put it to one side. If you have business equity, let's say you're a car dealer, pizza parlor operator, dry cleaner, whatever, that's how you make your living. Put that to one side. So the place you live and how you make your living, don't, you know, speculate with that money. Whatever's left over, those are your investable assets. I recommend 10% of that. Yes, but, you know, if half your wealth is in home equity, then it's really only 5% of your net worth. So maybe we're on the same page after all. But you should sell it if you need to. It's a way to preserve wealth if you have this panic. And I expect gold to go to $10,000 an ounce based on some calculations I've done, which I describe in my book, The New Case for Gold. At that point, if you don't need the money, then just sit tight. If you do need the money, you'll have it. Gold will have served its purpose for you. But I think a more traditional way is just to leave it to your children, and they'll have some wealth also.
And hopefully gold never goes to $10,000 an ounce for a very long time, because if it's 10% of your portfolio, you still lose with – it's going to be a very scary time if gold goes to $10,000 an ounce. So it's good to have insurance. And I think you're thinking about it the right way, or at least consistent with how I look at it, which is you want to kind of hedge your bets. You want to think of it as insurance. You may it's not something that you want to trade, right? You may very well hold it your whole life. Our guest this morning has been James Rickards. His book is The New Case for Gold. James, very interesting conversation. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks.
And we will be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchford, Marketing Director for Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program provides 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson for all children, kindergarten through fifth grade, across the state of Utah. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage service, and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Help keep Summit County Recycling clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Hello, I'm Justin Keyes. As an attorney in the Park City office of Jones Waldo, I'm pleased to support Mountain Money on KPCW. Our firm provides construction, real estate, and general business legal services to the Park City community. We are online at joneswaldo.com and can be reached at 435-200-0085.
I want to thank our great sponsors who support Mountain Money each and every week: Mountain West Bank, the Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones Waldo Holbrook and McDonough, All Resort Group, and Park City.
And I also want to thank our guests for joining us this morning: Brian Knepper, Casey Rind, and of course the author we just got off the phone with, James Rickards.
And Casey's website is upwardpersonalfinance.com, and Brian Knepper's CEO of StatMD, that StatMD location is by the Smith's gas stations at 1784 Uinta Way. So, Doug, I had an interesting experience long ago. I was doing TV news, and we went to the Johnson Matthey gold refinery. Most of this Nevada gold is refined into bars in West Valley City.
And I bet security was everywhere.
Oh, well, they measured the metal content of our bodies going in so that it would match going out. But they left me in the vault with bars and walls of gold and jeweler's gold, which are like little BBs in 5-gallon buckets. And they just left me there with all this gold and said, this would look good against a background of black velvet. Now, where is that black velvet? And they left and left me alone with all this gold. It was pretty breathtaking.
That would be fun.
Well, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. This is KPCW Park City.